Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room are Karen Bloomquist and Bill Strelo, who was speaking on engaging God, the church's vocation. So let's listen in on Karen and Bill.
We've been leading a whole week long series under the general title Engaging God, and we've been playing around with that and doing some kind of musing and reflecting on what that means through the week. I would say one of the best shorthand ways to get at what we've been trying to do is how can we move beyond God talk being, you know, some nice rhetoric that we, you know, repeat certain formulas and the creeds, etc., to a much more dynamic understanding of what it means to talk about God present and active among us in the very real situations that we find ourselves in, not only as individuals, but as families, as a wider society. And so therefore, we've been throughout the week trying to give some attention to the kind of context that we're in today, the context where individualism often prevails, not often, but does prevail, where there's a lot of cynicism, distrust, a sense of the social order changing, and therefore from within the kind of context that we as North Americans find ourselves in today, how can we understand, rethink some of the central understandings of who the biblical God revealed in Jesus Christ, how that God is active in our own day. So we've talked about that in terms of the truth-filled word, in terms of God's economics, or we could say God's providence, and how there's a very real way in which God's way, God's priorities are at times quite different from the priorities that operate in the market economy of our day. Yesterday we talked a little bit about that theme, Jesus saves, exclamation point, question mark, and looked at some of the different theories that the church has used for trying to understand what it means to talk about death and resurrection of Jesus having, you know, of what earthly good is that? So those are some of the kinds of theological musings, meanderings that we've been going through this past week. And today our theme is, or our sub-theme is, the church's vocation. And what we're especially wanting to think about that, so in other words, what does it mean then to be the church in the midst of these theological themes and discussions that we've been in over the past week? And so what I'd like to do is to lay out some thoughts that probably should be expanded, say the church's public vocation. Not only in terms of the message and ministry of the church as it speaks to the kind of individual plights and the individual searches for God that many of us are constantly looking to the church to shed light on, but also in terms of how the church engages those wider public realities that are around us. I would say one of the points we've been trying to make all along is that to keep God only in a very privatized kind of ghetto, to say, well, God has to do with me and my personal relationship, you know, with God through Jesus Christ, which certainly is a key part of our faith, that's in some ways to limit God if we only see God in those terms. And therefore, I think one of the real challenges in our day, in a culture of disbelief, a culture that in many ways has marginalized God, pushed God to the edges, to say, now how can we as communities of faith name those realities and speak a word about God's power, God's activity, God's truth in the midst of the realities that we find ourselves in. So that's kind of a basic theme that we've been playing with throughout this week. I would want to begin by suggesting, and I think this is implied in the summary I've just been giving you, is that the church's public vocation, the church's vocation in the world, arises out of the heart of how we understand God and God's purposes in our world today. And therefore, what we need continually to do as communities of faith in various kinds of settings, and probably the community of faith as it comes together at Holden is one of the prime examples of this, but I want us also to think about how the things I'm saying could take flesh, become more real in communities of faith that we might be a part of back home. We need to move from theology as rhetoric or a preface to what we do in the world to theology as something that continually accompanies us, that no matter what we do, whether it is, you know, as homemakers, as business people, as retired people, whatever, theology is, as it were, a kind of strand that goes along with us, that kind of permeates and critiques and transforms our life as we live it in the world. Christians, in a sense, always have two pairs of glasses on. The kind of, well, this is what I'm doing, and you know, all the tasks related to that, but then always being able to look at that through another dimension, through a sense of, now, how is God active in the life that I'm involved in? The church's vocation, and the vocation as it lives it out through the members of the church as we're engaged in the world, that vocation arises out of a radical and resilient faith that confesses God truly is active. That God, in the midst of all of the despair and all the cynicism, when we say, oh, you know, I just give up on what's happening in our society today, for example. There's so much violence. In fact, that's one of the themes we're going to be touching on in one of the sessions I'm going to be leading next week. In the face of all that, why even try? You know, our cities are going to hell in a handbasket. You know, there's not much we can do with the school systems, this, that. You know, the litany of despair and giving in to all of the problems could be extended endlessly. Somehow, the community of faith is that peculiar people of God that is involved in continually saying, what can we do to shape our communities and our relationships with one another so that they might be more just and more compassionate? And in the process, therefore, part of living out the faith that is in us, part of what it means to carry forth that vocation, is to challenge the brokenness, the bondage, the kind of untruths that are perpetuated in our world, the kind of alienation, to raise some questions when people kind of, you know, make little cocoons and kind of deal in their own private pains and really cut themselves off from one another. To challenge that is, I think, a central calling of our faith. And it's a calling of our faith that goes against some of the predominant functions that the church and religious institutions have tended to play in our society, which is that of often legitimizing, to kind of put a stamp of approval to go along with whatever is going on in society, to say, well, whatever the state does or whatever, you know, whatever the economy needs, you know, somehow we just kind of go along with that, and the church basically blesses or legitimizes it. And I think that in many ways has been a role that the church has often been expected to perform in society. And yet it's a role quite different from what we find in Scripture, where there's a message of that certainly arises out of the meaning of the cross that is continually out of sync, out of step with a lot of the kind of upwardly mobile, you know, if only you work hard enough, you too will make it into the American dream. A lot of that kind of message by which most of us spend a lot of our time living and at least trying to make sense of our life in the world. I want to suggest that somehow public, the church's public vocation is shaped from out of the heart of what it is that the church does. For example, preaching, going to church and hearing sermons Sunday after Sunday. What is the Word of God revealing and disclosing to us today in the midst of all those issues that are swarming all around us? How is the Eucharist, the Holy Communion, a kind of focal practice, a focal point for the whole of what the church is called to be about in the world, the kind of self-giving that we remember, that we participate in through that sacrament? What particular shape and content does the body of Christ, does grace, does hope take? And how can we articulate that in ways that truly speak to and transform situations of meaninglessness and despair and powerlessness? You know, how do we, in a sense, become the bearers, the vehicles of new life in the midst of a lot of the despair, a lot of the lack of purpose that we were identifying yesterday as one of the predominant kinds of themes in our culture today? It seems as though part of the task of proclamation, whether, you know, whether we are preachers preaching it or hearers hearing it and then realizing, well, somehow I'm called in my daily life to carry that forth also. Part of speaking that word is that of pointing to situations in our world that are not as God intends them. Now, how do we speak that word in ways that get heard? Not simply in ways that kind of hit people over the head so that they just kind of say, oh, you know, that's not very inviting. But in ways that really engage the questions and the issues that people are dealing with in their own lives. How do we experience that in our own congregations is something we may want to do some talking out loud about in our discussion period this afternoon. About a year ago, I remember part of my job, for those of you who haven't been around, is I work for the churchwide staff of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and so that means occasionally I get to visit other congregations besides the congregation that my husband here pastors in Chicago. And about a year ago, I was visiting a congregation, happened to be in Southern California, could have been anywhere. And the text for the day was about the kingdom banquet and who gets invited to that banquet. And the pastor preached what I felt was a very grace-filled kind of sermon about how Jesus' etiquette, Jesus' party inviting rules, I don't know if you use that language, but I will, somehow just violated all kinds of notions of who's inside and who's outside, who's to blame and who's innocent, all those preoccupations we might have of what's proper and right and all the other kinds of questions. And in his sermon, the pastor really, in some powerful ways, talked about how the kingdom ethic embodied by Jesus relativizes all of those criteria by which we try to order our lives. Or, you know, where we try to say, well, at least I'm going to try and feel in control, or feel that at least I'm okay about myself. I think one of the very treacherous tendencies in American society, especially because we, most of us in one way or the other, do have that hope that we will somehow be upwardly mobile, somehow, you know, better than the next guy or gal, is that, you know, we try to find all these ways that we can at least say, well, at least I'm better than so-and-so. You know, at least I live a good moral life, at least I do this and that. And all those ways that we try to somehow measure ourselves over and against others. And in subtle or not so subtle ways, convince ourselves that somehow at least we're a bit more righteous than others. Luther and Paul and others, are continually pointing to that as one of the real subtle ways in which the reality of sin comes through, namely of spending, you know, being really preoccupied with trying to make ourselves look better than our neighbor. And so it was one of those times, and I guess there are quite a few times, including my husband's sermons here, and hopefully when I was a pastor in the parish, where that kind of grace-filled reality really broke through to me, and I really needed to hear it on that particular day. But then afterwards, I began to discover how that grace, how that power of God really was an operative reality in the life of that congregation. We were having very difficult conversation afterwards about controversial issues. And I wasn't leading it, I was just kind of participating, kind of getting a bird's eye view of all of this. And one of the most eloquent testimonies came from a woman who, I could tell from her skin color and accent, was not one who would have been typical of many of the members of Lutheran Church. I think she was some kind of Hispanic or Southern European kind of background, but had very intentionally sought out this particular Lutheran congregation. And she gave an eloquent testimony saying, I knew that grace was not just rhetoric here, but that it was a very living reality in this congregation, in what I heard the pastor say, in what I experienced from the members. And I knew that this would be a redemptive community for me. And then she went on and began to talk about what it meant, therefore, to be in that kind of congregation when she had to face and come to grips and begin to share with others the fact that her son was gay. And she went on and talked about the grace that she experienced in a world that often would be very judgmental toward her, and particularly toward her son. And there were other stories too, but somehow hers really stayed with me. And I remember talking to the pastor afterwards, and he said, yeah, in this affluent, and it was a very affluent congregation, he said, I do know that she and her husband are probably the biggest givers in the congregation. Not necessarily because they're wealthier, but because there was a sense in which, you know, the gratitude, those of you who were around last night, gratitude was one of the themes of Vespers, that grace, that gratitude was just such an overpowering reality for her that was clearly the stance out of which they were rather significant givers in terms of their finances in that congregation. What I want to suggest is that the church in the world is not just, you know, an extra kind of thing. We say, well, this is, you know, the core of what the church is to be about, and it takes place on Sunday morning. But what happens on Sunday morning, as well as during the week in the community of faith, it's all intertwined, and it all together becomes a sign of what it means to really take seriously God's activity in the world. Through preaching, through welcoming the stranger, obviously this woman had been welcomed in some powerful ways. Through stewardship, through social ministry, through moral deliberation over controversial issues, all of these things were coming together in the 2 hours that I was present in that congregation, as well as all kinds of other social needs in the community that they were addressing. And it becomes kind of a part of a whole tapestry. You know, the theme here at Holden this summer is weaving a new world tapestry. And I think that, in many ways, is the theme of what the church's vocation in the world is all about. The church is in the conversion business, reshaping an entire way of living and a system of values and a way of how do we order, how do we organize our life together. Communities with practices that gather strangers together around a table to share a common space and a common purpose for the sake of the world. Now that's a very missional kind of focus of what it means to be the church, and much different from what might at times be a very institutional, self-perpetuation, survival kind of thing that especially many of us in small, struggling congregations, which have been the kind that Bill and I have been a part of for the last 20 years, it's very easy for congregations to be inward-turning, but I think that is to deny the reality that we proclaim. At the same time, part of the task of the church in the midst of that is to engage in some moral formation. How do we help equip one another to live a different way in the world? In contrast to a lot of the ways in the world that work against community, that disconnect us from one another. When I say moral, I mean that moral has to do not with moralistic, you know, these are the do's and don'ts, although certainly some of that too is a part of what the church teaches, but moral having to do with the shape of the whole. What is it in terms of the whole society that we are a part of? And how, in the midst of that society, do we make some connections? Do we try to constantly say, what is the common good, rather than simply go along with what is expedient and what is profitable? From the perspective of the cross, the pain, the anxieties, the fears that need to be faced, the woundedness, the mistrust, and the brokenness, these cannot be silenced or repressed in our world. But when we face those realities in community with one another, which is what the church's vocation is about in the world, then new life begins to occur, and we begin to discover it all around us, and not only as an internalized kind of thing between God and me. And then I think we begin to discover what it is that the new life to which Jesus calls us through the Gospels, what that is all about. So those are some kind of musings that I want to kind of finish off this series with, and maybe invite Bill to say some things, then we can all kind of get into the discussion a bit as to what might this mean, how does this happen, how do we struggle with these kinds of questions and issues in the communities of faith that we may be a part of.
I want to begin with a request. Okay. I want to begin with a request, and the request is very simple, but it will require you to dive deep into your own memory of your Christian experience, your Christian life, and then resurface in terms of some sharing. I would like one or two, or maybe three of you, to tell me your favorite story from the Bible of Jesus. Simple as that. In order for us to proceed in the discussion that we're going to have. So who would like to go first? Your favorite story or a favorite story from the Bible of Jesus. This man, unnamed man, I think we're told that he's young, he's rich, he has some power. He comes to Jesus and he has this fundamental question of life. What must I do to be saved? What other task is it that I have to do, that I have to achieve in order to be saved, to be right with God? And Jesus tells him to sell all you have, give it to the poor, and follow me. I think within that little capsule of biblical episode in the life of Jesus, we have some enormous opportunities to talk about the church and its public vocation, or what each of us within our own local churches, Our Lord's Lutheran Church in Chicago, Illinois, and you can name yours, what it is we might be about or are about in our Christian life. I want to read to you, and I want you to keep in mind what Gary said about that favorite story of his about Jesus, and how the more we probe that story or any story about Jesus, we have an enormous amount of material and information to consider. This is a writing by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, as many of you know, was martyred by the Nazis. He was hanged toward the end of the war, hanged not with the rope, but as the Nazis were prone to do, hanged by a piano wire. And a few days before his death, he wrote this letter to one of his best friends, whose name was Eberhard. "It is your birthday in a week's time. Once again, I've taken up the readings and meditated on them. The key to everything is the in him. All that we might rightly expect from God and ask God for is to be found in Jesus Christ. The God of Jesus Christ has nothing to do with what God, as we imagine God, could do and ought to do. If we are to learn what God promises and what God fulfills, we must persevere in quiet meditation on the life, sayings, deeds, and death of Jesus. It is certain that we may always live close to God and in the light of God's presence, and that such living is an entirely new life for us, that nothing is impossible for us, because all things are possible with God, that no earthly power can touch us without God's will, and that danger and distress can only drive us closer to God. It is certain that our joy is hidden in suffering and our life in death. It is certain that in all this we are in a community that sustains us. In Jesus, God has said yes and amen to it all, and that yes and amen is the firm ground on which we stand." Now, having heard these words of a Christian pastor who was hanged because of his aggressive resistance against Hitler and the Nazis, and having heard Pastor Gary's sharing with us a favorite story of his about Jesus and Jesus' life, I want us to recognize that each of the stories that we might tell about Jesus and Jesus' life, or as Bonhoeffer was saying, his life, his sufferings, his sayings, and his deeds, each of those sewn together give us an understanding of why Jesus was crucified. Because each of the sayings and each of the deeds and each of the actions that Jesus did, in some way, shape, or the other, shattered, broke apart, broke open, or exposed the scripts of life that people had followed. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says, go, sell all you have, give to the poor. It's clearly that Jesus is telling us that there are poor in the world, and the rich keep their distance from them, and that if you want to find out who God is, you need to follow Jesus. Broke apart that man's life, but he could not follow. And we can give examples of different stories of the life of Jesus that, when linked together, became the reason for which Jesus was crucified. When we talk about the responsibility or the task of the work of your local congregation, my local congregation, because we are indeed called to a particular task, a particular responsibility, that task proceeds from and ushers forth from the stories that we could share with each other about the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. This vocation or this task that each of us has, and all of us have together, states and enacts that the saving act of Jesus on the cross is not the end of God's story. The story continues with what you and I understand to be the resurrection. And this vocation is certainly this vocation, this salvation that the cross talks to us about, is certainly not a private assurance of our relationship with God. All you have to do is to read the Acts of the Apostles to understand that. The resurrection of Jesus, the cross of Jesus, did not keep them insulated and isolated. To be sure, they were that for a time, but brought them out into the world. That they knew that they had to continue that story that Jesus began. Continue out of the same mindset that brought forth stories like Pastor Gary shared with us. So salvation is the continuation of God's work by the folks that Jesus befriended, some that Jesus challenged, and certainly the work by the folks who followed Jesus. And what I want to suggest, along with what Karen did, is that our church membership gives us a particular outlook and a particular work, a particular task, a particular responsibility, no matter if we're a little child, no matter if we're 80 years old, in the world in which we live. Jesus calls us to follow. Those stories that we hear in the Bible, they're not there just for entertainment. They're there to shape us and form us. Jesus calls us to follow a risen and a scarred Jesus. I'm always somewhat disturbed when I see pictures of Jesus in churches, because it's never a risen and scarred Jesus that we see, at least not what we grow up with. We grow up with a kindly Jesus, a Jesus that is fair-skinned, a Jesus with a lamb in his arms. And what people like Bonhoeffer and others are telling us is that you and I followed a risen and a scarred Jesus, and we are to follow that Jesus and not simply to admire him. And so three then things that I would like you to consider along with me. The task of the congregation that you are a part of is to say that Jesus lives, Jesus reigns, and because of that, all other powers pale in significance. Last night, one of the directors of the village was saying, it's as if we live from the future, that we pull something out of the future and we live it in the present. That we know that in the end times, all people will be one. And we pull that out of the future and bring it into God's presence, because we know that Jesus lives and God reigns, and all other powers are insignificant. We borrow from God's future, but that fellow is also willing to say, that's easy to say, but it's hard and it's risky to do. When we pull something out of the future that is of God, we're saying that to talk about love is not enough. We in the church talk about love along with a lot of other people in society, but we also talk about love that leads to a sense of purpose and responsibility. That God's people say, Jesus lives, the people of Jesus love, and at the same time, the people of Jesus live a life of purpose in this world. And I believe that we can begin to talk about this, or at least ponder it in our own minds and hearts, in at least three ways. That the community, the place you call church, your local congregation, is a group of people who are willing to talk about the world, and are willing and quite eager, I would say, to critique it and say what's wrong with it. Just as Jesus did with this story that Gary talked about with us. The man comes, asks Jesus the question, Jesus shatters his world and say, what's wrong with is that you've got too many possessions, and you want more and more security, but your problem is you're unwilling to be insecure. Sell all you have, give it to the poor, and follow me. And he couldn't do it. Jesus was giving a critique, was questioning this man's way of life. The people that follow Jesus do the same thing. We're involved in a critique, an analysis of the world that you and I know has not been stitched together by God, but stitched together by people like you and me, and people like you and me who are more powerful than we are. And sometimes we think of this world, or we're taught to think about this world, that's the way it is. It cannot be changed. When somebody retires, they retire, and they're of no benefit to anyone. That's not the world that God sees. That's the world that we have created. It's a world where one person says, we get up every day for achievement and reward. We get up every day to enhance our own privacy of life. It's a world where over 10% of the men of my congregation, when asked to name their hero, listed John Wayne. Now that's quite a bit different from an understanding of what a man might be from who Jesus as a man was. They listed John Wayne. None of them listed Jesus.
And so when we go back to Chicago, that's one of the things that we're going to have to talk about. And these are good men. These are men that worked hard, laborers, still continue to work, doing things around the church, but their hero, the man with whom they look to for their sustenance and their identity, is John Wayne and not Jesus. And we need to talk about that. The local church, the local congregation, all of us continue what Jesus began. We become those who critique a way of life and are not simply the custodians of a way of life. And again, remember what I said. When Jesus did that, when Jesus did each of these acts, similar to what Gary says, when linked together, they became the reasons for which Jesus was crucified. Secondly, then, an alternative life. When we're talking about the local congregation, people like us, we live life in a different way. One writer puts it, we're pioneers, and I think he puts that because it fits in well with the American mindset. We're pioneers in creating a different way of living. Just as Jesus was that pioneer saying, no, that's not the way you live. You do not accumulate your riches. Because the more and more you accumulate, the more and more there are poor people. The alternative way of life says, no, somebody's worked 40, 45 years, and they retire, they should not be forgotten. They still have contributions to make. One can still learn from them. They can still become mentors to the children. They can still tell stories. They can still serve at the altar. They can still take communion to shut-ins. That's alternative vision of using in a positive way what other people might say or other structures of society might say. These folks are retired. It breaks apart, or at least suspends, the habits of heart and mind that you and I may have. That's why I ask you to think about those stories of Jesus, because I dare say that each one of them, particularly the parables, broke apart or suspended the habits or the way of life that people were engaged in. And those parables, those sayings, those acts of Jesus are what ultimately got him crucified. Alternative way of life, I think of a group of people in Brooklyn, New York, members of congregations who recognized that there was very, 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 very little affordable housing for people like them. And yet one-on-one, they could do nothing in order to achieve any kind of conversation with the government of New York City in order to build low-cost housing. So 33 congregations brought themselves together and formed a coalition of people who are saying, we have the wherewithal, we have the knowledge, we have some financial backing, we need a piece of property that has been abandoned from the city in order to build housings. And they built 3,500 housing units. It was an alternative way of life. People looked upon them as having very, very little assets because they were poor. But they said, no, we have a lot of assets because we have a vision of the way we'd like to live. An alternative way of life involves dealing with the manners by which we deal with the powers that be. Are Christians always passive and polite? Or are there examples in the stories that you can remember of Jesus where Jesus was not passive and he was not polite? Are there stories where there might be some hard language that we in our communities have to use in order to sustain life and hope? In other words, when we talk about church history, we're not talking about the past. The church had a past, but the history is going to be made by folks such as you and me. And then the third mark, if you will, of the church is that of a sanctuary, a safe haven. And we're more familiar with that than we are with this first two. But a place where we can worship, where we can pray, where we can share with each other how we have been hurt, and hear from each other how they have been hurt by a society that does not take the actions and teachings of Jesus all that seriously. In other words, the marks of the church, its public vocation, is in to engage the world, but not with the assumption that we are going to solve every problem that the world has. Or as one writer put it, it's like house cleaning. You think you're going to have a clean house 24 hours a day, but you never do. There's always some other task to be done. And then to end with this, the congregations that you and I are involved in are in the participation of suffering love in history. And again, remember those stories of Jesus. Participation in love against powerful evil forces without assurance that goodness will be the victor or the victor on the scale and the terms in which we set. As I said, the cross and the resurrection of Jesus are not the end of the story, but they're the continuation of the story of God's work in this world. And that story is to not admire Jesus, but no matter how old we are, to follow him.
So, what do those comments from either one of us begin to trigger in you? Let me just begin by saying one thing that, while you're thinking about your comments, I think to underline the implications of what Bill was saying, and to a large degree what I was saying too, clearly this kind of involved engagement with God becomes risky, becomes unpopular, is not what goes over well in terms of many members of our church. Who would like to say, well, I come to church to get away from all of that. And yet, you know, what we've been trying to say through this week, it is because of our confession in a God who very much is involved in this, that we do get our fingers dirty. And therefore, hopefully nothing quite as dramatic as crucifixions or hanging in the gallows, but at the same time, I continue to be amazed with familiar phrases of, well, we don't want to get involved in that because it'll be divisive, because people might stay away, they'll get angry. And the last thing we want to do is get angry in church. And yet, you know, as soon as we say that, the kind of yes, but, well, yeah, we should, you know, be for this, be for that, but it might affect our finances, it might affect our numbers, whatever, that in itself becomes a kind of conversation stopper. That when that's the, you know, the be-all and end-all, then I think we at times can sacrifice what it means. You know, we fail to see what it is that the church's vocation in the world is all about. So it's risky. We're not talking about it being a kind of popularity contest, or certainly the church is, well, a kind of club for all of us who like to be together, but there's always that something beyond that that calls us and makes it inherently messy business. And therefore, to constantly think through and talk through, now how do we uphold one another so we don't just get compromised? You know, a few weeks ago I was rather excited to, you know, on McNeil Lair to see April Larson, the first and only female bishop in the ELCA, was actually surveying the community she's from and how the current president was or was not going over there. And apart from the kind of comments on that, I think the main thing that she said, and she said, this is true for any leader, and I talked to her afterwards because I ran into her the next week. I said, I think you're saying church leaders too. She said, yeah. And just said some very eloquent things across public, you know, the PBS stations across the country about the need for leaders to take the stance, to realize there's going to be fallout, but not simply to back down. And she was actually applying it to some critique of Clinton at the time. But I think more and more that's what isn't present at times when the church tries to go along with the culture to say, well, we want to be popular, and yet it's not a popular kind of life of discipleship that we're called to follow. What are some of the questions, some of the issues, some of the maybe the yes buts that you want to engage us with?
I guess kind of speaking from within the circle of clergy, most of my colleagues are pleasers. And most of my colleagues are not confrontive. They do not like conflict. So, you know, I think there's a kind of a dilemma to start with. If the quarterback, not necessarily the coach, but if the quarterback, you know, wants it to all go smooth and to make sure that each year the budget grows and each year worship attendance grows. And I just hear this over and over. So one of the questions for me when you say what's the role of leadership is how does leadership that's not ordained support leadership that is ordained in the call to be faithful? I think that's a real issue. You know, if it affects my salary, I'm careful. I mean, I don't ever have to be obnoxious or abrasive. So that's a reality.
There's so many layers of conditioning in terms of the church and its clergy being chaplains of the way things are. That to really get into this stuff that I think is in deeply biblical kind of stuff is really a tough road to tread. Other comments? How do some of you who are lay view this, so this doesn't just become a clergy discussion here?
I guess I'd like to to ask the rest of you here the same question a little differently. Is there any way in which you as a Christian would like to impact the world that you feel thwarted at, or blocked, or intimidated? Where you want to live out an alternative lifestyle? You know, where you critique things and you say, this is not what God would want. Is there anywhere you need support in moving faithfully?
Any response to that?
Who just came in today? You're going to respond to that? It's the first day in the village. Okay. Well, I want to offer a challenge then, at least a challenge to you as we begin to leave this place. And that is to think about the last time you went to the communion rail or received communion. And recall the words of institution. Jesus took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and gave it to the disciples, saying, take and eat, this is my body, do this as often. And what? What did he say? Remember. Same thing with the wine. Seems to me that one of the first, if not the first task, that you and I have as pastors, as unordained people, except we're all ordained by our baptisms, is to remember the stories of Jesus. Each and every one of them. That the narrative of the Bible tells us, and overcome sometimes our reluctance to share those stories publicly. Because it's only because people, after that resurrection, began to share the stories of Jesus that you and I are here today. That they were able to say, oh, I remember that story. I remember that time we were with them and the children came up and we didn't want them to do anything and Jesus told us to basically keep our trap shut. Without the memories of the people who come for the communion, the story of Jesus cannot continue. So it's just a challenge that I would give you this week.